This episode of Rhodey Radio is brought to you by your local library's Library of Things. Did you know that your library has more than just books and movies? Libraries across Rhode Island lend out all sorts of unconventional items. You can borrow fishing gear, ukuleles, tools, games and puzzles, telescopes, and more. Whether you want to try a new hobby or keep the kids occupied, Ocean State Libraries have what you need. Contact your local library to find out what's in their Library of Things. You're listening to Rhodey Radio, Rhode Island Library Radio online. I'm your host, Lauren Walker, from the Rhodey Radio crew and Coventry Public Library, and today I'm talking with Judith Calahora, the founder and artistic director of History at Play, which educates and entertains audiences with their immersive living history experiences. Judith is a professional educator and living historian. She founded History at Play in 2010 to chronicle the lives of influential and often forgotten figures. Judith researches, writes, produces, and performs the productions, along with employing guest artists globally. She has entertained audiences all over the world, and we are excited to host her here today on Rhodey Radio. Hi, Jude. Is Jude okay?
Jude's great, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we just met recently when you did a performance at the Coventry Public Library as Deborah Sampson. And we all loved the performance, but for those who don't know about this kind of living history program, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do with your company, History at Play?
Absolutely. We take primary sources, first and foremost, and biographical sources that are very reputable. We use that as the foundation for a script. And the performances are generally all ages, though a lot of the concepts that we cover do highlight concentrations that can be more mature in terms of social rights, human justice. And these programs are immersive. I like the term immersive living history experiences because the audience is always involved in the story in some way. It's generally a one-person show, although we do have ensemble productions as well. And by necessity, in a one-person show, you do use the audience as sort of a character, whether they be like a Greek chorus or whether there is a call and response aspect to it, or even onstage volunteers for younger youth audiences. And that's like more of a soliloquy kind of experience where the performer speaks directly to the audience. And we use all of that to create an experience that brings you through this person's life. And these are influential figures in history who may not have received the credit that they deserved.
Yeah, that's great. I know we had a little boy at our program who actually does like reenactment type stuff with his family. And so he was perfect to like jump right into your performance. So I thought that was great that you took volunteers when it applies.
I love to do it. Whenever we're at a school, we always use volunteers. Whenever we're at a community program or an adult event, and there happen to be a kid, a grandkid, or a child in the audience, then I'll always ask the client if they'd like me to pull some students or some kids on stage.
Yeah, I know the living history programs, everyone who comes to our Coventry adult programs, at least, because that's what I do, they really love those. So it was nice to have, sometimes kids come too, and they really like it too. So tell me about yourself. Have you always loved history? How did you get started acting? What's your story?
Always loved history. Father is a big history buff, so he used to do a lot of storytelling. They weren't necessarily the most engaging stories, the way he told them, but he was truly passionate about it. And sometimes that passion is what is necessary, even if you don't have the professional oratorical experience. I started performing when I was eight. Two students, female students from Boston University, their graduate program thesis was to start a drama program at a public school that did not have one. And lo and behold, they came to my school. I love telling this story because I hope one day one of them will hear it. And I'll say, I don't even remember their names. I was eight. And I went to Juniper Hill School in Framingham, Massachusetts, and it's no longer operational. It's defunct now. And they came and they started this improv troupe. And I was like, well, improv, what is that? I don't want to have anything to do with that. And I saw at the end of their session, the students that had participated would come into our class and show an example of what they had learned. And they created like a machine with their bodies, like different gears and parts. It was like, I think it was a candy machine, like a gumball machine or something. And I was like, so mesmerized by this. And I was like, I want to turn into a gumball machine. And I sort of signed up for the next class they offered and I was hooked. And then they started producing traditional theater. And the first performances I ever did with them was Aesop's Fables. And that was it. The rest is history.
Very cool. I know I always love doing like these history programs or history podcasts. I actually ended up majoring in history for my undergrad because I started off majoring in journalism and I hated it.
Oh, really?
I didn't know what else to do. I know, it's so weird. Like I really hated interviewing people and now somehow I'm doing it again and
that's
I don't
so funny.
Hate it anymore.
You've come sort of full circle back to the thing you didn't like. That's well, you got to face you got to face what makes you uncomfortable. And that, and once you kind of let that wash over you, the discomfort melts away.
Yes, exactly. And also every professor was like, this is a dying industry. Good luck getting a job. And I was like, oh my God, this is a bad idea.
I'm actually really surprised. I went to Syracuse and journalism is one of the, they have one of the top programs there in the country, at least when I was there. Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to have my minor be out. My major was performing arts, acting. And I wanted my minor to be journalism and they would not allow you to minor in journalism. You had to major in journalism. So they told me if you'd like to switch your major, you're welcome to join us. And I had to like audition to get into Syracuse. So I was like, gosh, do I want to not throw that out? But I didn't, you know, journalism wasn't something I saw myself going into, but I always loved it because I love telling stories. I love teaching. I love getting the other side of things, you know, and it's like kind of bring an aspect of journalism into my programs, because if I'm portraying someone who was more recently alive, like Krista McAuliffe, the teacher in Space, for example, I get to interview people who knew her. And that's like a huge part of the research is oral histories of either people who were there or who knew that person. And so there is an aspect of journalism to what we do as well.
Yeah, it's funny too, because our library director also used to be a journalist. So there's something about journalism funneling into librarianship, I guess. But yeah, long story short, journalism didn't pan out. So I majored in history just kind of to be like, this is the other thing that I like. And that ended up becoming, I had to get a master's degree to do anything with a bachelor's in history.
Yeah.
So and that's I was gonna how ask I ended you, up becoming a librarian.
Did your history professors ever say like, Lauren, you're never going to find a job in the history field?
They didn't. And
yeah, that's funny and crazy that the journalism's did.
Yeah. Maybe they all assumed that everyone in their class wanted to be a history professor and that was just it.
Funny. Very interesting.
Yeah. So what made you decide to bring these historical figures to life?
Well, I think it goes back to college for sure. My junior year, I want to say, of college, I was involved in a program called Voices of Pan Am 103. And for those of you who are not familiar with Pan Am 103, it was a flight that crashed over Lockerbie, Scotland. And I believe it was 1985 or 86. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact year. I apologize for that. And most of the students that were traveling back from their semester abroad from London to New York from Syracuse were on board that flight, which is the same program that I would end up doing about 20 years later. So it was it's always been a very big part of Syracuse culture. There's a scholarship called the Remembrance Scholars that goes to a student really of the highest caliber. And that's in honor of the students that passed away on that flight. And it was a terrorist bombing. So there was a teacher at the school, Joan Hart Willard, who collected the diaries and letters and like photo album pictures and art of the students who'd been on board. And she compiled it to create a performance called Voices of Pan Am 103. And I was fortunate that I was selected to portray Louise Rogers, was her name, Louise was her actual name. Luann was her nickname. And Luann Rogers was a visual artist who had actually come from another school, but Syracuse has a very good abroad program. And so she went with Syracuse to London. And it was the first time in my life since I had been 8 years old that I had a play script where I didn't have to come up with my own backstory for the character. Suddenly I had letters, photos, art she had created, voice messages that she had left on her parents' answering machine. And I was able to create a human that was not contrived or based on deduction. It was based on fact. And I'm a very creative person, and I'm also a very factual-based person. I like to teach. And so the aspect of knowing that what I was saying was right and knowing how I was portraying her was accurate was really, really important to me. And once I had done that, I thought, I don't ever want to create a backstory ever again when I can create something that's real. And Governor Michael Dukakis, who ran for president a long time ago, he said, I saw him at a lecture, and he said, oh, I never read fiction because the truth is so much more interesting. And sort of that's kind of how I feel about theater now, is I don't mind doing fiction plays or plays written by a playwright that are not necessarily based on historic events or actual events, but I much prefer to do programs that are based on history and primary sources. So that's how I started. That's really the first person I ever portrayed that was a real person.
That sounds like it was like a good place to start for you, because also you felt like you could relate to her as well.
Yeah, like I'd been on the same flight, you know, 20 years later. I had the best time of my life when I did my semester in London. I performed at the Globe Theater. I trained with the Globe instructors. It was really sort of the formative experience of my educational career, and certainly launched me into the professional world with a knowledge that I was capable. And to have that all taken away on the flight back, like I couldn't get myself out of that headspace of like having the best experience of my life and knowing I was about to take the world by storm. And then knowing that you're going to die, right? Because it didn't, the plane, you know, they hijacked the plane. And so there was some moments, I'm sure, where the passengers on board were aware that this was not going to end well before it actually did blow up. It was really, really wrenching in a way that gave me sort of like this is my act of service. Like this is what I need to do with my career. And there's a reason why like families and people are relying on these stories to be told. And so I carried that into, you know, a few years later, starting my company, basing my programs off primary sources, real people.
And who are some of the historical figures you portray, and which one is your favorite?
Well, the historical figures range like 250 years, and they range different industries as well. So I like to cover subjects that span all of my vast interests, which are very, very vast, to say the least. I think I mentioned Krista McAuliffe, teacher in space. So space has always been a huge interest for me. And like my mother, when I was graduating from high school, my mother said, Jude, you can either go to theater camp or you can go to space camp, but I will not send you to both. And she made me choose. And she often would give me big choices like that at various points in my life. And I did choose theater camp. And now I get to play, you know, a person training for the space program in a program that I've had the honor to write. So Krista McAuliffe is certainly one of my favorites. But my real favorite, I would say, and I'll tell you about some of the others, but I do want to get my favorites out first. My real favorite is Deborah Sampson, who you have also experienced that program. And Deborah Sampson was the first woman that I wrote a program about. And Deborah Sampson, for those of you who don't know, she was a soldier in the American Revolutionary War. And you're like, how could she be a soldier? She was a woman. Yes, she disguised herself as a man, and she concealed her identity, and she enlisted and served for about 18 months, so nearly 2 years of active combat in the Hudson River Valley of New York. It's like Westchester County, Dutchess counties. And she served with prestige. She earned a rank of officer, we believe up to corporal, although there are varying sources that say she could have even been promoted to a higher rank and perhaps refused it, which also makes sense because she didn't want to attract a lot of attention to herself. But she, even dug a musket ball out of her own thigh when she was injured in combat to ensure that she was not discovered. And she is honorably discharged ultimately by General Henry Knox in October of 1783. And the reason why she was discharged was because she fell ill with a fever and she was discovered by a surgeon, and he actually nursed her back to health and then sort of sent her back to West Point with a letter to her commanding officer. And her story just gets even more interesting as she goes on. She ends up applying for a military pension, which she ultimately gets, but 20 years after service. She ends up going on a national lecture tour to help promote a book that was written about her life. And it's just like, first woman to be paid to be a professional speaker, first woman to enlist successfully in the army, first woman to be honorably discharged in the military. It's just so many different firsts. And she's also the official heroine of Massachusetts, which is where I'm from. And that state, Massachusetts, was the first in the nation to declare a person to be an official symbol of their heritage. So to have not only the first person be a woman is one thing to say the least, but a woman who then crossed societal and gender norms and essentially was a very gender fluid human being, although that term didn't exist at that time. That for me is like the best of both worlds, right? Like, she's not just a woman being a woman. She's a woman showing that a woman could be, quote, a man, right? Whatever that actually means. Those are my two favorites. I'll just give you like a sampling of some of the others. Hedy Lamarr is a Hollywood film star who was very active in the 1930s and 1940s, what we call the golden age of Hollywood. But she was a technological savant, and she invents this technology, which she calls frequency hopping, which is actually spread spectrum technology, which allows Wi-Fi to essentially hop from one radio signal to another and not jam up a signal and to not be traceable. So it's a secure wireless communication network. And she submits it to the Navy during World War II, but she doesn't get any credit for it. And now the whole world is based on the concept, everything, GPS, Bluetooth, so on and so forth. One of my other favorites, not forgotten, certainly not a forgotten figure, but our newest program is about Princess Diana, who she was such a role model to me growing up. And I didn't realize as a child how much she struggled with mental health challenges and compulsive behaviors like bulimia, cutting, suicidal ideation, and having battled as a creative person myself with mental health struggles over the years, depression, and significantly more so over the last couple of years because of COVID, it was really important to me to bring a story to light that not only confronted mental health, but that also showed how someone who really defied all odds, like, she was struggling with this. She would like vomit 4 times a day, you know, for 10 years. She was a severe bulimic. And yet she still somehow, in spite of people in the palace calling her, you know, borderline personality disorder, imbalanced, unpredictable, she was still able to go out and fulfill her duties and be a humanitarian and bring light and joy and happiness to so many people all over the world. And she didn't stop. And like, she fed off the only thing she really made her happy and comfortable was bringing joy and comfort to other people. I think that's really beautiful. And then there's so many others. Dolly Madison, a woman named Lucy Stone, who was a leader in the women's suffrage movement and abolitionist movement. World War Women is a compilation of 5 different women's stories from World War II. I've written 13 productions for the company and more to come.
That's awesome. I have to ask, do you or have you watched The Crown?
Yeah. So it was interesting. I loved the first, I don't know, what was it, 5 seasons? Whenever they brought Diana in, that first season they brought Diana in, I couldn't watch it. I hated how she was being depicted. It was so anti-Diana. And then I was like, all right, buckle down. I was writing the program, but I had kind of finished the drafts, because I didn't want to watch too much of it while I was researching and writing the program, because I didn't want it to infiltrate my research. Because we all know these TV shows, they are based on fact, but we at History at Play are a historical educational entertainment company. The entertainment is the third word in the description of the company. And so the first and foremost needs to be historically accurate and educational content. So once I had written the drafts, I did watch it. And the second season that they had her in, I was just like, I didn't particularly love how she was being portrayed, but the actress who portrays her was so spot on with like the way she like tilted her head. Cause I'd been studying this. Like one of the things I really do is I really try to emulate. I'm a bit of a chameleon. So like, I try to really emulate how people look, how they hold their faces, the shape of their mouths when they speak, like the tone of their voices when they talk. And I was just blown away by this actress. And I haven't actually watched the new season, but I heard they just like skipped over her death, which is pretty upsetting to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Sorry. Spoilers.
No, 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 no. I'm trying to remember. I think the last season, because I think I'm like caught up. I think the new season comes out next month or maybe in September. I thought someone was saying, is it already out?
So my friend who is very involved in TV and film production said that in the new season, he believes they jump forward into when William met Kate.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So basically they're going to skip. And I don't know if the, honestly, I think the palace has something to do with that.
I have to say, like, in the most recent, like, not the new one, obviously, but the last season, I felt like it was weird how little Harry was in it. Like, he exists, he's a person, you know? So I already was like, alarm bells. I don't know why they left him out. Unless my only thought was it came out right before his book came out. And I thought maybe they were like, let's wait and see like what he says about his own life and add it in. Like, I wasn't sure if the writers were on like UK side or Hollywood side, you know?
I don't think it has anything to do with the UK. And I think it has to do with the palace, or as Diana called it, the establishment. Right. And the establishment goes back, as we know, you know, the Windsor family, hundreds of years, but the royal family, thousands of years. Right. And they are not a country. They are not a government. They are not anything. There's no way to classify them. You know what I mean? They exist in a world unto themselves, and they have power that we can't even begin to fathom. And that power is very scary. And I give Harry a lot of credit. I don't agree with everything Harry's done, but knowing, so Harry and I are, Harry's a little younger than me, and knowing how it affected me, like when Diana died, a very crazy thing happened to me. And it's, I don't even know if I should go into it, but it's almost sort of supernatural. I have never, ever fainted in my entire life. And when I remember, it was, so she died, it was like right around midnight, but like Paris time. So you kind of have to take time zone changes into consideration. But I was taking a shower to get ready to go to my friend's bat mitzvah. It's a very, very specific memory. And I was finishing up in the shower, and suddenly I got super, super, super nauseous, like so nauseous. And the shower wasn't particularly hot or anything. I wasn't like sick or anything. And I'm like, what is going on? And I like held onto the wall, and suddenly everything went white. And the next thing I remember was hearing my mother scream at the top of her lungs. And the next thing I remember after that, I still couldn't see anything. I could just hear. After my mother screamed, I heard down the hall, the TV said, it was a news reporter saying, we've just learned that Princess Diana has died in a fatal car accident. And that was how I came back, and I opened my eyes, and still all I could see was white, but it was actually the white porcelain of the bathtub. And I had fainted, which I've never fainted in my entire life, never fainted ever again. And I smashed my head on the side of the bathtub.
Yeah, I was like, going to say.
I was bleeding like down my face. There was like blood in my eye. And my mother obviously heard this like clunk and like went in. That's why she saw me. She screamed. And it was so surreal because it like hit me in such a way that like, I don't know, I'm very spiritual. I'm very connected. And she was so important to me. I was so inspired by her work in Angola with the clearing of the landmines and her work with AIDS patients. And I was always very involved in the theater industry. So even as a young person, like starting theater at the age of 8, I knew what AIDS was because a lot of my theater directors or teachers like had friends who had died in the AIDS crisis. So like they didn't talk about it forthright, but it might've like come up, my friend died. And I'd be like, what did your friend die of? Oh, I'm sorry. And they'd be like, my friend died of AIDS. And then you're like a kid, but you're like, what's AIDS, right? So like I knew about her involvement in that crisis, in that, during that epidemic. And I think just in some way, I was just like spiritually connected to her. And it just like took the breath out of me. And as someone who was the same age as Harry, who wasn't even related to this woman, but now having lost my own mother, I lost my mother a decade ago. Like, I can't even imagine what his life was like. And although I haven't read his book, I do know that in his book, he does talk about that he didn't know she was dead and that people didn't talk to him about the fact that she was dead. And he thought she was alive somewhere.
Yeah, I did read it. And it was more like, you know, everyone is like, is it true, blah, blah, blah. But assuming that what he writes about his own life is accurate, it was the middle of the night, his dad came in, told him what happened, and then just left. And he was in a dark room by himself for the rest of the night with this knowledge that his mom had died. And then he kind of like, as a kid who had no, he didn't even get a hug. Like he had no way to process any of this. He always held this idea, you know, it was a closed casket. He always held this idea that she wasn't actually dead. And it wasn't, he talks about like, there was a moment when he was an adult. He like finally came to terms with the fact that she really had passed. Like he was still, even as like a teenager into adulthood, thinking like, he might walk around a corner and see her and that she had like fled and because of all the media and she would come back for him. So
there are people who there, if you go down the rabbit hole, because I was researching her for years and continued to follow research about her. If you go down the rabbit hole on social media, there are channels, there are accounts that believe she's alive and like have taken photos in like some sort of facility, like skilled care facility of like a woman's silhouette that like is alarmingly like Diana's profile. And you're like, this could be AI. This could be just Photoshopped. Like, and then there's like one part of you, which is like, well, yeah, it was a closed casket. And yeah, there was no real photos of the actual accident. There was no video camera from the accident. I'm not saying the accident didn't happen, but like, was the accident fatal? You know, like you could talk about families who had tragedies happen that basically like concealed that person, like the Kennedys, right? Like, I can't, what was it? Rose or something?
Rosemary.
Yeah. Rosemary gave her a lobotomy because she was just, was developmentally challenged. And they were like, oh, this will cure her. Gave her a lobotomy and basically turned her into a vegetable and then just made her disappear.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, if the Kennedys can do it, which is the only family in the United States that has like sort of this similar,
right,
not being able to be categorized as the royal family, then who's to say the House of Windsor can't do it?
Right? Yeah. I do think though, like, I feel like her kids were so much of her life that I don't think she would have been able to do that.
Well, but if she didn't have a say in it.
Yeah, know. Maybe she didn't. I don't know.
Now we're down the conspiracy rabbit hole.
I know. Well, I think you were saying, I mean, I think you did talk about Christina, is it Christina or Christine
McAuliffe? Krista McAuliffe.
Krista, yeah. McAuliffe and Deborah Sampson. What are a few facts that people would be surprised to know about them?
Ooh, Krista's husband, Steve, she was like 16 years old and she's like, Steve, if you ask me to marry you, I will say yes. And she'd like never dated anybody else. Like it was like love at first sight for them. And aww. I mean, she'd gone out on a date with some kid from her street. And he was like, will you marry me? Aww. And they were 16. And she said yes. And then they decided to wait until after they graduated from college, which is probably for the best since they were both attending Catholic high school. The scandalous. I always love that story because there's like, you know, people are like, oh, childhood love, whatever. But I do know, I have a friend that they met in middle school and they got married and they're still married. And so I like that aspect of it does exist.
Yeah,
she was also, Krista McAuliffe passed the bar exam in New Hampshire. Oh, wow. So she was actually able to practice law. So she was actually teaching a law class at Concord High School at the time of her selection. I think that's really cool. She wanted to go into administration, so principal, vice principal, but her principal at Concord High School said that the school was not ready for a female administrator. This is in 1984, 85. Yeah. So not surprising, but also very interesting. And I think she probably would have continued in education and gone into, some people think she would have gone into politics, but I personally think she would have gone into administration and then done some speaking engagements had she survived, had the program been successful. For Deborah, let's see, sort of in the same vein, we'll start with kind of a funny. So after Deborah was discharged from the Army, she did actually get married. And 7 months after she got married in 1785, she had her first child.
Uh-oh.
Which is so funny because people are like, not that time. But I'm like, no, these are 18th century colonists. These are not 17th century Puritans.
Right.
The Puritans of the 1630s and the American colonists, specifically the Boston area American colonists from the late 1700s, are like, if you could swing from one side of the pendulum to the other in terms of radicalism, that's what you've got.
Yeah. You know,
puritanical, conservative, like if you don't go to church on Sunday, you're going to be put in the stockades and publicly humiliated, to like, let's overthrow our government. Oh yeah, it's the strongest empire in the entire world. No problem. We can get that done.
Yeah, I'm actually reading a book right now called The Season, and it's the history of the debutante. And I actually just got, it's only like a couple chapters in. I read it before bed and I read like two pages and I'm out. So,
so it's not very interesting.
No, it's reading in general. I usually listen to audiobooks because actually physically reading a book, I don't know what whatever my eyes are doing, it's making me sleepy.
Same.
But I just got to the chapter where they kind of, it started off talking about women or girls being like launched on society in England, and then over in the colonies, like the same kind of rituals started, and like it was so much decadence. There's one point where it mentions that John Adams wrote to his wife that he was disturbed by how sensual all the jellied food was.
Wow.
Yeah, so I guess jelly molds and jellied food was like a popular trend, and
probably maybe, shaped.
Yeah, I don't know, but there was a lot of decadence apparently.
Well, I mean, one of the women I portray, that it was a commission for the Hingham Historical Society, which is on the South Shore of Massachusetts, is Sarah Derby, who founded the Derby Academy, which is the first coeducational private school in New England. Okay. And she met her second husband, Richard Derby, at the house in Salem of the Massachusetts Supreme Court judge. And I am going to kick myself for not remembering. I could look it up right now in my notes, but then you're going to hear me clicking on the computer. He was the Supreme Court judge of Massachusetts. He presided over the trial of the Boston Massacre. So John Adams was the defense attorney in that trial. So he had at his house, it was called the Pleasure Gardens.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Massachusetts had parties at his house called at the Pleasure Gardens. So wow, you can only imagine what type of things were going on in the Pleasure Gardens.
Yes.
You know, I have a couple ideas, but I won't vocalize them.
There was probably jellied food.
Probably at the very least. I don't remember how we got on this.
Deborah Sampson, 7 months.
Oh, yeah. 7 months giving birth to her first child. 7 months. Okay, so something else that's really cool about Deborah Sampson. So now we don't know, I can't put this in the performance because I don't have like a verified primary source. It's in Herman Mann's novel about her called The Female Review, but there's two editions of this novel. The first one she signed off on, the second one she was dead, so she couldn't sign off on it. Both are available. One of them that's online is the second edition, so she didn't sign off on that one. That's sensationalized and thought to be highly inaccurate. The first one you can get in hard print at like the Massachusetts Historical Society, and some other archives might have originals. But she actually, there was a nurse at the camp that developed feelings for her. And of course, like Deborah was you know, didn't feel comfortable speaking or getting close with a lot of the guys around her as like, you know, hey buddy, because they called her Molly because she couldn't grow any facial hair. No. She just said she was a 15-year-old boy, but you know, if people start prying too much, it's going to get more and more difficult to remember what you told to who, so on and so forth. So she kind of befriended this nurse, and this nurse started to have feelings for her, and the nurse proposes to her, which is sort of unheard of in the 18th century, but in a time of war, I think anything goes, right? So Deborah, according to the lore, writes a letter back to this nurse and says, you know, I'm very flattered by this offer, but I simply cannot accept. Signed, the same sex. And that's it. So she signs this letter in a manner that doesn't connect her actual name in any way to it, but informs the person, and the woman, you know, according to the lore, she understands and she just lets it go and just honors the secret.
She's just like, sorry, I am.
He's just like, wow, now I know why I liked you so much.
Right.
We could talk.
No wonder you're dish together. That's funny. Okay. So is there a particular time period that you find the most interesting?
Certainly the American Revolutionary era, late 18th century America, or late 18th century world, I think is a really interesting time in history. I think it's like, I don't know if you watch Outlander, if you've read the Outlander series, but
I'm like a season behind, but
yeah. Oh gosh, it's so amazing. It's like if I could have any dream come true, that would be my dream. But like the ability to travel back is also part of that dream. Yeah. Because would I want to live all the time in the 18th century? Heck no. Like, no, I would not. I do like having plumbing. I do like having, you know, antibiotics. I do like the modern marvels of the world and of the human species. So from a, like, if I were to go back and like stay there, I think the 1920s before the stock market collapse, like the roaring 20s, I would definitely see myself like after World War I and before 1929. If I could hang out in that decade, I think I'd be just at home there.
Nice.
Yeah.
For the freedom at that time.
Yeah. I mean, 1920, women earned the right to vote, right? Women's lib. That's an 85-year recorded process of like first woman to really speak in front of Congress petitioning for the rights of humans and therefore the rights of women is Angelina Grimke in front of the Massachusetts legislature. And I want to say that's like 1835. So 1920, right to vote. Well, now you're talking. Now I want to be a part of the society, right? Because I'm actually a part of the society.
Right.
Secondly, the music. I am like, people have that one thing that feeds them besides, you know, for me, besides performing, it's music. So I say music is my religion. And the music from that era is just absolutely phenomenal. It's just top notch. And that sort of big band kind of feel, and the dancing, the Charleston, right? This, the fashion, the flapper dresses, this complete, it goes from like, sort of compare it to like, you know, 18th century, you've got the stays and the bum rolls, and then you go to the Regency era, like, and there's just like, hey, oh, let it all flow.
Yeah.
Let it all lay loose, like the empire waist dresses, no more restrictive corsets. And then you go back to the restrictive corsets in the, you know, antebellum and the Victorian era. And then in the 1920s, it's just like, all right, girls, it's off for good now. Just let it all hang loose. And, you know, I love that. I mean, the first thing I do when I get home is like remove the restrictive garments off of my body. So
yeah, that makes sense. But then you go back to it with like the girdles of the, I don't even know, maybe
the 50s and 60s. Yeah.
50s, yeah.
Yeah, you do. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Although I feel like, okay, for me, like if I were going to go back to visit, I would do like 1969. I don't have to wear a girdle. And I, you know, there's enough of like women being more independent and free that I could do most things on my own. But I think if I were to pick a time to live in and stay, I would pick the 90s, because I have a personal theory that life satisfaction peaked in the 90s, where like we had the advantage of using computers for information, but they didn't take over our lives. And like kids still played outside all the time and everything. And women had rights for the most part. I mean, you know,
yeah,
we could say that about today,
except for like Monica Lewinsky or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's history for women is, as you know, always, there's always the aspect risk of like, but you're a woman, so
yeah.
I feel like to live in, I would go back to the 90s, but to visit also for like the music and the interior decorating and the clothes, I pick late 60s.
Yeah, those are really good. Those are really good choices too, and I can absolutely vibe with the sentiments for both of those eras.
Yeah. Well, if you could have dinner with any famous person, alive or dead, which one would you and why?
See, I always feel like I have to put that there's not one answer to this and there has to be like categories.
Fair enough.
Because for example, as an actor, I don't do a lot of TV and film anymore, but I used to. And you know, when the opportunities arise, I still take them. But my work as an artistic director and founder of History at Play and being on tour all the time definitely does take up a lot of my time. But if I were to be involved in a cinematic production, I would really, really, really want an opportunity to work with Quentin Tarantino. And so like, I'd love to like have dinner with him and like just talk about his films and his influences and, you know, why he chose certain people to work with. What was it that he saw in them? Why he feels he needs to do a cameo in all of his productions? And like, when can I audition for his next film? That would kind of be like what the dinner would entail. So from a cinematic perspective, definitely Quentin Tarantino. Historically, I mean, it's kind of an obvious answer, I think, but Deborah Sampson. I mean, I've been doing research on this woman's life for 18 years. Wow. And I still don't feel like I have the answers to some of the major questions that I want to know. And I feel like she communicates with me as much as she can through the outlets that she has. And for folks who have seen me portray her, weird things sometimes happen when I'm portraying her. Lights will flash. Things will happen in the program. Specifically, this happened in Sharon, Massachusetts, which is where she lived as an adult. And so the DAR, Deborah Sampson, Daughters of the American Revolution chapter, can attest to the fact that weird things do sometimes happen. She does like let me know she's there and she does give me hints, but it's nothing like just being able to sit down and just pick her brain, you know, because I can only infer based on following the tracks that she was in, making the trying to see both sides of every option she was given. And then why did she choose that option instead of the other option? There's only so far I can go before I'm making something up, right? And then from like just like a life perspective, oh gosh, just like in general, I think about this all the time. And so I'm from a very international family, and so my father's from Turkey. And then like also my ancestry is from Spain. And so I often follow the path of history and why my family moved from one place to the next. And so in my case, it was generally religious based, like my family is Jewish. So they were really cast out of Spain during the Inquisition. It was like convert, leave or die. And then of course my family emigrates to Turkey, and then Turkey has anti-Semitism on the rise. And then my father emigrates out of Turkey for that same reason. But obviously when you think about all of this and you think about your heritage as a Jewish person, the Holocaust is like such a big part of our like shared existence. And one of the first people that made me really like understand the Holocaust in a different way was Elie Wiesel. And his book that I read in like elementary school, and we wrote him letters and he wrote back, and it was like amazing to have this experience of, what was that? Is it Into the Night? Is that the, oh gosh, man.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And like to have this experience of reading this book and then be like so compelled that I'm like, I need to write this man a letter. And I'm like a kid, right? You know, I'm like, I think I was in like fourth grade or fifth grade or whatever. And then to have him write back, I always was like, I want to know what it was to live in like pre-war Europe, when Hitler was coming into power. Is such an interesting time for me, mm-hmm. because people just think like, oh, he like usurped power. Like he did everything totally legally, totally by the book, totally with the approval of the public, totally mm-hmm. swayed the public into this mass hypnosis of like blaming one group of people for literally all of their problems.
Right.
And then evoked this massive hysteria of, if we get rid of this group of people, Hitler will think we're good little girls and boys and will treat us nicely. Right.
Yeah.
And like Elie Wiesel wrote it in a way where I like, I could understand kind of, and I just would wish I could sit down and have dinner with him to tell me more about what it was like to live sort of like the Weimar Republic kind of lead up, you know, what was it like to be in society and to watch these things happen, you know, from the legislators changing to Kristallnacht, where the protesters really first smash all the windows. And there's that first really public, globally recognized moment of, let's get rid of these people, let's make their lives miserable. But there was a lot leading up to that. I would like to pick his brain more about that.
Yeah.
I went down the Debbie Downer rabbit hole there. I apologize for that. But that's the truth of the matter. That is it.
Yeah, no, those are all very interesting people. That's so cool that he wrote back to your whole class.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would imagine other classes were doing that too. So he probably spent a whole day writing letters to kids. That's
I'm sure
cool.
it brought him great joy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, because that's what you do when you write a book like that, is you are praying or hoping, whatever word you choose, or, you know, willing that it's not forgotten.
Right.
Because that's the only way we're not going to do it again. And we are canceling out things that make us uncomfortable. And by removing a book from the bookshelf, banning a book from a curriculum, you are not making it okay for anyone except you in that moment. You right. are ruining the future of society and the future of your children by denying them of the knowledge that that book brought into your landscape. And it made you uncomfortable. So ask yourself, why is it making you uncomfortable? Don't make everyone else be bereft of the knowledge that made you uncomfortable.
Right. You know, I always say as a librarian, if we were to remove from our shelves every book that either someone just didn't like or offended someone, like we would have no books on
exactly.
any of our shelves.
Exactly.
And that would include, I mean, it would include Harry Potter. It would yeah. include Captain Underpants. Like the Wizard of Oz was banned at one point because they didn't like a strong female character. That was literally the reason. The Lorax was banned because of its portrayal of the foresting industry. Like
yeah.
you could find a reason to pull any book off of a shelf.
Yeah.
And so the thing that you actually do is you leave them all on the shelf.
Yeah.
And there's actually a movie called Storm Center. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's kind of obscure and probably only librarians know about it, but Betty Davis plays a librarian.
I like it already.
Yes. And so someone on her library's board, I believe, or like the town or city council, wants her to remove the Communist Manifesto from the library, and she refuses. And she's like, how is anyone ever going to know how dangerous these ideas are and what the ideas even are if they can't read the book? You know, at the time it came out, it was like everyone was afraid of communism. And so yeah. she was basically saying like, A, you can't understand what you're trying to fight if you don't even know what it is. And B, you're giving power to the communists by saying that their book is so dangerous that you can't even look at it.
Right.
And she ends up getting fired, and there's like this whole thing, but it's a really good movie. And it was like surprising that it was made in the early 50s, and it holds up.
a lot, you know, there's, and I wrote it down because I am really interested in watching it. And there are a lot of movies, like even Hedy Lamarr, she created her own film production company called Mars Productions, like Hedy Lamarr, Mars Productions. Oh, yeah. And her films never got distribution because of, it was strong female characters, but one of them specifically was dealing with sort of a woman who was like, had some addiction issues and compulsion issues. And she tries to commit suicide at the beginning of the film. And it just turns, it flips the whole world upside down on like what a woman, because like these were like man problems, right? Like, right. And it just, she, and it's called The Dishonored Lady. You can watch it on YouTube for free because it never got distribution. Wow. The Strange Woman is another film she did. And she not only produced them, she starred in them and she directed them. And incredible. The Strange Woman, she depicts herself sort of as like very manipulative, dark character that kind of manipulates people into committing heinous crimes. Wow. For her advancement, and she couldn't get distribution for them. And they're brilliant films. And I think if she had had a stronger director to help her, her performances would have been even better in them. Like, she's often limited by, you know, having directed and produced my own programs that I perform in, to share your headspace with all of those other hats can be very difficult. And one end eventually will end up suffering. And especially for her, with English being her fourth language, you know, it's definitely that sometimes her moments of acting are perfect and some moments of her acting are really forced, but like, it is never at a point where I'd be like, I don't want to watch this film. And I recommend everyone watch The Dishonored Lady and The Strange Woman, which you can watch online for free on YouTube.
I will definitely watch those.
Yeah, really good.
I think I would probably also have like two options for my dinner guest as well. I think the first one that always comes to mind is Carrie Fisher. First of all, a huge Star Wars nerd, but
it's all right, Trekkie here, but we'll agree to disagree about okay. Which one is better.
Fair enough. But also, she's written a ton of books. I mean, she wrote like, I think, 3 or 4 autobiographies, but then also a bunch of novels, which were also semi-autobiographical.
Yeah.
But I just feel like she would be so great to have a conversation with. And she was always so like honest about herself, her struggles, her life. And I just think she would be so funny and just like a good time to hang out with her.
Yeah.
And then the other person is, I used to work at the Newport Mansions, and Rosecliff was always my favorite house. And the woman who lived there was this woman named Teresa Ulrichs, but she went by Tessie. And she was a friend of Alva Vanderbilt's, and no one really knows a lot about her. There aren't a lot of like records about her. It's supposed that she was always like the life of the party and very funny, and she played banjo and stuff. And she just sounds like she was really interesting, and I would love to like know more about her. So kind of in lines with your Deborah Sampson, I think I would also choose her.
Yeah. Sort of reminds me of an Isabella Stewart Gardner kind of character. Isabella
Stewart Gardner. I don't know much about her. I've been dying to go to the museum, but
you got to. It's free on your birthday, or it's always free if your name's Isabella.
That's cool.
It's a really, really cool place. It's unlike any museum in the world. And she's just like this, you know, I don't think she's like playing a lot of instruments or anything. I don't think that's part of her, but she's just this incredibly cultured, right? She's the first woman, I can't say anywhere ever because I'm not going to be that superlative, but she travels the world basically by herself. I mean, obviously she's got people with her who are servants and stuff, or, you know, hired help, but she travels the world specifically to collect art and, you know, not only art, tapestries, sculptures, musicians. She finds musicians from all over the world, and she just literally uses her husband's funds to create a house that will be forever for the people to enjoy, featuring in exactly the formation that she wants it to be, every piece of art that she's ever collected throughout the course of her life. And she's just like this, she's not particularly attractive, so she must have had this absolute enamoring energy. And she just seems like such a phenomenal person that she could have had every man at her doorstep. She wasn't a particularly, you know, good looking woman, but yet she just was so knowledgeable that what the world needed more of was culture and
art. That's really cool. I definitely have to get there. Yes. I know some libraries have passes too.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely. Your library will definitely have either a reduced pass or a complimentary pass. That's how I go to all of the museums, like the ICA.
Oh, good.
I see, when you work for libraries, so when you perform for libraries, amongst other places that, you know, we perform everywhere, but a big percentage of our clients are libraries, you then start to realize how much importance and value libraries have in our society, right? They're not just places where you go to get books. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what happened in Dudley, Massachusetts with the Pearl Crawford Library. But
I believe
it's shut down. It was a very bureaucratic nonsense move that shut it down and laid off all of the librarians. And they're one of my clients. And I was reading the posts on social media and it was like, well, those places are obsolete anyway. And like, you know, some people were like, are you kidding me? These are places that, like, you know, kids go there after school. It's a safe place for them to be. People go there for educational programs, you know, myself included. I perform there. It's literally how I make my living, is having libraries be functional. And, you know, what people don't realize is now the town's library loses accreditation. Now the citizens of that town can't go to another town to use their library. They're like literally not allowed. And it's really going to mess up the whole town of Dudley, Massachusetts. But you know, libraries, one of those very many ways that they support the community is you get free passes like everywhere. Amazing. There's so many libraries that you actually don't even need to be a resident of that town. Like, I have a library pass for a library card for the town system, the network that I live in. But then I have a Boston Public Library pass, even though I live right on the edge of Boston, technically in the next town over. And then I have a New York City library pass.
Yeah, in Rhode Island, it's a statewide system since we're the smallest state. So if you have a library card, say from Coventry, you can use it at any public library in Rhode Island. So, you know, if we don't have the museum pass or the book or whatever you're looking for, you can just go to another library, or not with museum passes, but with materials, we can order it from somewhere else.
Very cool.
Which that leads me to my final question. Do you have any books to recommend to our listeners, either, you know, biographies or historical fiction or non-historical, anything, whatever you like?
And your attestation about listening to audiobooks is also true for me, because I have a photographic memory, which is a blessing and a curse. It makes it very difficult for me to pleasure read, because if I find the content interesting, I will stare at it until I've committed it to memory, which it's about double to triple the amount of time that a normal person would take to look over the page. And so that makes pleasure reading really difficult. And so I listen to audiobooks because I'm on the road all the time. And so it just keeps my brain going. So I do always love to recommend books that correlate to people that I've researched. So if you do find Deborah Sampson's story interesting, as I have over the last almost two decades, I recommend reading Alfred Young's novel, Masquerade, Life and Times of Deborah Sampson, Continental Soldier. Alfred Young, for those of you unfamiliar with his works, is one of the best historical biographers and just historical writers, I think on par with David McCullough. And he does incredible research, and it's all in the footnotes and the bibliography and the index. And he also includes in the Masquerade novel biography, I should say, he includes like facsimiles of primary source documents. So like, if you can't get to the Massachusetts Historical Society or the American Antiquarian Society, you can still see a copy of the image in the book, which is really cool. Another book that I think is really, really interesting, just in regard to like, just like understanding human behavior, is called The Originals. And I'm kind of blank on the author's name right now, and I'm sorry. But The Originals taught me a lot about like different creative styles of thinking. Like, procrastination is not procrastination in the negative sense of the word, because we are planning everything in our minds and then we execute things very, very quickly in very small condensed amounts of time. Because when I do programming, I'll be researching for like a year, and then like I'll write a script in like, you know, a week, and then I'll do a revision. and then I'll rehearse it. You know, I'll rehearse it for like 2 weeks and then I'll put it up. But over the time that I've been researching it, I've been collecting all of the props that I want to use, all of the set pieces I want to use. I've been designing the show from a scenic perspective, costume appropriation. So I like design the program first, and then I like write it in a really short amount of time. And I rehearse it very, you know, because when you write something and when you're a professional performer, you don't need a ton of time to rehearse something. Generally kind of, you learn how to do things more efficiently. And so I always thought, oh God, why am I waiting so long to do this? Why am I such a horrible procrastinator? And then I learned, like, Martin Luther King Jr. was up writing his speech for the I Have a Dream speech at like 4 a.m. He started writing the speech. He's done it like sunrise. And then guess what? He stood up on that podium and some woman behind him said, tell him about the dream. And he threw out the whole script and he just went off book, just went off the cuff and said, I have a dream.
Wow.
So it's like all of this, like, you need to be prepared. You need to take more time. You know, you need to check the boxes on this to-do list. I'm like, well, what if I get my, you know, what if my to-do list, I can do the amount of work in, you know, 1 week that someone takes a year to do? Does that make me not as prepared a person, or does that make me procrastinator in the bad sense of the word? No, originals are original for whatever reason. Some plan and some don't. And I recommend that book for people who want to learn their styles and what that means.
Very cool.
Thank you.
Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know that we didn't touch on?
I'd love our listeners, especially those who are history lovers like myself, to follow us on social media at History at Play across all of the platforms, even TikTok and whatnot, if that's your thing. And we also have our website, historyatplay.com. We're going to be adding our autumn shows to that upcoming events tab on that website very shortly. We send out an email blast once a month. We'll be sending one out this week. I'm not sure when this will be aired, but nevertheless, once a month, I hope you'll sign up and come to one of our programs. We do them in person all over the country, not just in New England, but all over the country. And we do have virtual options as well for streaming our performances on demand. So, you know, I just ask that you all make history and have a great day. And thank you for having me, Lauren.
It was great chatting with you. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. Thank you for listening. You can find more information about Judith Calahorra and History at Play by visiting her website, judithcalahorra.com, or on social media at History at Play. There you can find information about upcoming events near you, and of course, I always recommend subscribing to your local library's e-newsletter. On top of the usual library news, you'll be the first to know if Judith is coming to your library. Rhode Radio is proud to be a resident partner of the Rhode Island Center for the Book, and brought to you by library staff and community members all around the Ocean State. This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, an independent affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Rhode Island Council for the Humanities seeds, supports, and strengthens public history, cultural heritage, civic education, and community engagement by and for all Rhode Islanders. You can find more from Rhode Radio on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you enjoyed today's episode, subscribe to Rhode Radio and give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to help us reach more Rhode Islanders.